Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Johnny Tremendous. That's my name today.
Okay, what do you think? Johnny.
No, isn't your porn name is... No, it's your middle name and the street you grew up on.
Yeah, something like
so
that.
So what's yours?
What do you define growing up? What time period?
Like, let's say born.
Born? I have no idea. If you're talking like elementary school, it would be, it would be Brad Mountain.
Yeah. Okay. That works. Brad Mountain. Okay. Wait, no, that's, Brad's your middle name,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Brad Mountain. All right. And then the other one is, your first pet and your mother's maiden name.
First pet.
Yeah.
So let's think. Wait. So I think it might have been.
Yes.
It's, I think it would be. Wait a minute. So we had a couple dogs when I was a kid, and I don't remember which came first.
Well, what's really, young. I mean, for the sake of us doing a podcast, which Gunther, one had the funnier name?
I think it was, Gunther.
Yes.
McCallum.
Wait, Gunther what?
McCallum.
Oh, that's not that much fun. All right. Gunther had some promise. Cause then, I mean, we started this interview. Did we talk shit about Germans?
Yes.
In the intro?
We talked shit about Germans at the beginning and then we praised Germantown and towards the end.
Oh,
that was very ironic.
Yeah. Okay. Cause I was going to go ahead and do it again. When you said Gunther, I was like, oh, okay. Scheiße porn, you know, but now I feel bad, but I just did it again. Oh, do we have a large German listening audience? We probably don't, right? You see the numbers.
Yeah, no, it's not huge. We do have
not huge.
I can't remember. I haven't zeroed in on Germany. I've just looked at Europe sort of as a whole.
It's funny though. I mean, it's like, it's one of those things you talk to anybody.
No, I know it's recurring.
Who hasn't visited. Yeah. I mean, every single person in a touring band just tells the same exact story. There's nothing wrong with the people, okay? I've been there so many times, I've figured it out. There's nothing wrong with the people. The big difference is Americans are always fucking around.
Right.
We are never serious, even when we're serious, and sarcasm does not exist in Germany. It just doesn't exist. So every time you start to fuck around, they think you're being serious. And then all of a sudden you're down this wormhole where you can no longer have a useful conversation anymore, you know, but there is that thing. I don't know. It's hard not to think, like I said in the interview, that every once in a while they're taking your pants down, you know, maybe because you're American, right? And you know, oh, you've been pretending like you're exceptional for so long. Let me take this small opportunity to take your pants down a little, you know, maybe that's where it's coming from.
It's become part of their thing and it works for them. I think that's what it is.
I mean, Give me a Spätzle any day. So I have a funny story about Nothing is a great band. I've been a big fan for a while, ever since Tired of Tomorrow, kind of been following their work when they recorded with John. But the funny thing that happened that really tied Nothing into my everyday narrative is that the phone, I've had the same phone for, you know, I don't know, 8 years or something. I don't like changing these things. And the first song that pops up anytime I plug in my phone in the car, anytime I start a party shuffle, is the song ACD, which is track 4 on Tired of Tomorrow. It's right. Called Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. And song's badass, you know, but basically it goes, you know, right at the beginning, there's a big riff and a groove. And my son obviously has heard this fucking thing about 5,000 times because I plug it in, it starts, and then right. I put on whatever music I'm going right. to listen to. And maybe about a month ago, he just started asking me to let it play through.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, you know, cool. Like, I'd rather listen to fucking this than Sparkled Stories on the way to school today. Like, cool. It's good. That was some Nothing. And then it turns from like just wanting that song to like, daddy, play the record. Let me see the front. Then asking me questions. Then demanding I play the album on the way to school and stuff like that. And now my 5-year-old son is like a shoegazer fan. Like, he is an actual Nothing fan who's sitting in the car, eyes looking out the window, jamming the shoegazer, which is like, I don't know if I could be more proud of anything, you know, like
it could be way worse.
Yeah. So Nothing, that's why, you know, we have a little bit of a guest spot today from a family member coming in, because Nothing has started to play a very important role in my family. Funny, huh?
That's hilarious. And it's also, I mean, it's hilarious the way that happens, because the same thing happens to me. It's like whatever is in your like iTunes alphabetically is what it is. Cause it's right.
Is that why it's, yeah. Cause it's ACD.
Do you know what mine is? Which I didn't even know was in my fucking iTunes library, but it's the same. It comes on every time. And it took me forever to figure out that that's what was happening. It's like, I think it's Ella Fitzgerald, a tisket, a tasket.
Oh, shit, really?
which like, I have no idea. I mean, it must have been from my wife's collection, because she's got a lot of wacky shit. And like, you know, I ripped all of our, like, back in the day, ripped all our stuff together and uploaded it to iTunes. And that's the first song to come on when I plug into, like, a car with my phone.
Okay, that's not bad.
A tisket, a tasket.
How many? Let me ask you this.
It used to drive me so crazy because I didn't know where it was coming from. I'm like, why every time we get into a rental car is this fucking song on?
It's always here. Yeah, I used to get annoyed. I'd be like, oh my God, this fucking song again. But, you know, now we're about to listen to a Nothing interview. Luckily, my wife's, the first song that comes up on hers is an Exploding Hearts song. So, I mean, those are two things that are good to inundate your kids with, right? Nothing and Exploding Hearts. Right. But let me ask you this. How many people throughout the world get an ABBA song first thing?
Well, it's the title, though. It would be ABC. It would be like Jackson 5 or something. You know what I mean?
So what song starts with AA? Is there a song about Aaron Burr? I'm Googling
sure
it right
is.
Now. Someone wrote a song about Aaron Burr.
Well, there's got to be one from Hamilton, dude, right? There's got to be a Hamilton
song. Oh, yeah. Here it is. It's called Aaron Burr, Sir.
That's it. So how many of you out there get that song? Comes up on your phone. It's got to be, I mean, I think you have to have an iTunes library, though, because that's where it's pulling from.
Oh, sorry. I was going to play Aaron Burr, Sir, but here we go. Hang on. This is so how many people out there in the listening audience?
What the fuck?
This is the first song. Penny, oh my God, they really rap?
You've never seen Hamilton. You've never heard of the Hamilton song.
He actually raps, huh?
Oh my God. You're so lucky that you've completely, I mean, it's not like Frozen, but yeah, my kids have been into it for so long. They can rap the whole fucking record. My kids.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah. And my nieces, there's three of my nieces, and they sat in a park and literally ripped an entire Hamilton song going like verse to verse, like they were the fucking Beastie Boys or something, you know, they were like trading off verses. Yeah. I'm like, oh my goodness.
I've witnessed it, dude, for the past fucking 3 or 4 years.
Well, I guess it's time I saw Hamilton, huh?
No. It's okay. It's okay. I saw the version on that they showed on TV where they just filmed the play.
Yeah.
It's impressive. It's an impressive feat, but you know, it's whatever. It is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many ways I could say that, I just don't care. I don't care that much.
You know how many kids have learned about history from it though? Really, for that, it's a huge success, and I applaud it immensely for that.
Yeah. That is pretty cool.
Cause it really has taught a lot of kids stuff that there's no way they would fucking absorb otherwise.
Good point. Brad, I'm going to do something we never do. You ready for it?
Fart into the mic?
No, I do that every time. I'm going to talk about our Patreon before the episode starts. Because I finally remembered.
Because I'm such a bad promoter.
We're both not the best whores in the world. But we did start putting some cool stuff on there. That Chris Shiflett episode from last week. There was a good extra like 10, 15 minutes of fun chat that we threw up there.
Yep.
So if by the end of this episode, you're not super annoyed by us and you thought it was good at all, you know, do something to help us if you want. How's that for a pitch?
That's great. It's a great pitch, yeah. Dude.
Okay. What's the link? Say the link.
Patreon.com slash going off track.
Right. Me and you are the worst. We should just be asking for like checks by mail. If you like the way we sound, please put anything you can in the mail to P.O. Box 7782. And then we'll mention your name on the program. Okay.
Check or money order preferred.
We're the worst. We got to youthen up. How are we going to get more contemporary? Should we get like a 19-year-old like co-host?
Oh, God.
Just to like, no. Just so we don't, so we're not boomers.
Maybe we could get a 19-year-old producer to take care of all the tech stuff so that I don't have to keep up with it.
There you go. Because every time you try to do something, you need to like Google instructions, right?
Sometimes, yeah. Time.
Let's listen to this great interview.
Yeah. It's going off
track! You know, there's this misconception that all like skinny people are healthy. You know, and a lot of my friends who are the biggest rippers there are the people who are super skinny. And I'm just like, listen, you're not healthy. All you have inside of there is just like one gerbil in a wheel, just kicking around, like looking for some cheese. You know, you're not doing well on the inside.
the skinny guys, are always getting away with it. It seems like,
of course,
they never get bellies from drinking for like years in a row or anything.
But then at like 45, they get the super obvious beer one, you know, the one that just sits right in front.
The pregnant belly.
Skinny fat.
Yeah.
Skinny fat.
How's your body doing these days?
It's bordering, what I'm trying to think of it like a muscular dystrophy almost from not moving around at all.
Yeah, a little bit of atrophy.
Yeah, atrophy is actually what I guess I was looking for. Yeah. The other day I was really jammed up like trying to get these interviews done for Europe, and they were all in text, so it was just like a whole day's work. Yeah. And I looked at my phone at the end and it said I'd taken 9 steps throughout the day. So that's some insight on what's going on with me. Pretty much.
I'm actually kind of impressed though, because that means you got up like once.
I got up, walked into the living room to get coffee, and then just that was it.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good focus, actually, if you can do that. I don't know if I could get my head into written German interviews for that long. I would have had a lot of steps by default. walking away from the computer when you hear your new record is not as good as old record. Why is this?
Exactly. So usually when I stack all those up and for one day where I'm just going to be like, all right, I'm going to handle all this bullshit today. And I'll wake up early, take an Adderall, drink some coffee. So I start going crazy. I usually kind of talk a little not reckless, but like I'm very sarcastic, especially with the Germans because
of what
you just mentioned. So like, you know, I've learned to have a good time with it. But
smart.
it's still really punishing. So by the end of the day, I'm just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like I'll have a little bit of weed, and when the Adderall and the weed start mixing together, my answers get really strange. And so I'm kind of on that right today. Maybe you'll get some weird stuff out of me.
I hope so. I mean, it's funny with, cause there's no matter, it doesn't matter how much you fuck with them, right? Like the whole reason the interviews are strange is because there's a strange, like, lack of humor. You know what I mean? So when you start messing with them, they just get more and more confused sometimes, you know, when you start
honestly, that's kind of how I've learned to not get like upset with them. Is to just like turn it back onto them and just confuse them.
Yes.
So like all my German friends are very, even, you know, are very confused by me because by default, even the ones, you know, even the Germans I'm friends with and stuff, I still treat them like differently than everybody else. I suppose it's probably a little bit problematic, but what are you going to do? You know, it's German.
Yeah. Listen, it can be a very emotionally taxing group of people to be around. So you got to find ways to protect yourself.
You already know. The first time I went there, I was, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but
no, please.
The first time I went there was on tour with my old band Horror Show.
Right.
And it had been our first time being over there. And, you know, the first show that I played, I stage dove and fell on top of some kid's head and broke two of my ribs.
Oh shit. So
while we were sitting, I was sitting in the merch booth and this German guy came up to me and was just like staring at me for a while. And I wasn't very familiar with like what to expect by that point. I've only heard like, you know, your typical stories, but yeah, the guy comes up to me and he just like, he's like, Dominic. I was like, yeah, I'm in pain. He's like, is it true that you murdered a man?
Oh my God.
the first thing he said to me. And I was just like, no, that's not. And he was just like, he just like nodded up and down and was like, do you have this in an M?
I
was
God. Yeah, yeah.
So my first experience with Germans didn't let me down. And,
yeah, good talk. My ribs are fine, you know?
Yeah.
I remember one time the singer at Gaslight, Brian, had to get an emergency tooth pulled in Germany. It was a show, I think, in Hamburg or something. So literally like 2 hours before the show, he's in so much pain. He's got to go to a place, you know, it's Germany and Europe where they don't believe in drugs. So he's basically given like two Tylenol and then had this thing, like I think two of them ripped out of his head. And then managed to get back to the show, managed to play almost an hour set with these two just, you know, like pulsing. And of course, they don't have painkillers there either, you know, so you're just on like Tylenol. Yeah. And even after that show, the same thing, where they're just like, your set was a little short tonight, you know? I'm just like, guy, like, what do you want? I mean,
no, there's no borders with them. Just like, you know, you get the typical... The record is great, but the live set, not so much.
They always got to take your pants down a little. It can never just be like a full, like you're doing great.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I come in hot on them. I'll be like, what do you got to say? What was wrong with the show tonight? What's going on? And they're just like, they also don't know how to handle that. So like, they're just like, you put them in the like overdrive. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's so strange. Cause as an American, you take what they're saying as confrontational, right? But they're actually like the least confrontational people. when you actually like get into it. It's really strange. I remember another quick German story. This is why I call it going off track, buddy. This is why we do this. One time, you know, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but have you ever been like on a stage or on a festival and just knew that they were talking shit about you in another language?
Yeah, that's like every show we ever played.
Yeah, exactly. Like you can't confirm it, but you know human nature, you know eyes, you know faces, you know body language, and you're like, these motherfuckers are talking about us, like definitely. Yeah. And one time I was a few weeks in and I'm at a festival and I was constantly getting into fights with German stagehands because, you know, they're nuts. Like you're off stage for 15 seconds and a group of like six dudes with no neck is like breaking your drums down. And I'm like, yes, it's all rental shit. I can't lose anything. Everybody just clear the fuck away for 5 minutes so I can do this, you know? And, you know, I told them that. And then I see a side conversation going on a couple glimpses my way. And in my limited like English German accent, I was just like, shut the fuck up. I know what you're talking about. You can't talk about us on stage. This is bullshit, but totally bluffing. I had no idea what they were saying. And it completely confirmed all of my biases because they're like, oh, no, we were not saying this. We were saying this. I'm like, gotcha, motherfucker. I had no idea what you were saying, but I knew it. I knew it.
Fuckers. Listen, motherfuckers, man.
You gotta go deep with them. So
yeah, man.
So where are you right now? You're in East Village, or
yeah. I'm in East Village, New York City. I was supposed to wake up a little early today and try to go food shopping before this.
Oh yeah,
this next whatever the fuck is going to happen. Who knows? They're saying 10. They're saying a foot now, but it could probably be 1 inch or 60 feet of snow going by the way that this year is going. So who knows?
Yeah.
I didn't make it to the grocery store either way. So, I'm just here, sitting in this little tiny apartment. You guys are in Jersey, huh?
Brad's right by you.
Yeah, dude, I'm right downtown. Oh. I'm in Lower East Side.
Oh shit! I'm on 10th and C.
Hi, I'm at Grand Street.
Nice, we're neighbors.
Yeah, I get up there all the time, dude. My kids take guitar lessons from that guy on the corner of like 6th or 7th. You know that little shop there?
Oh yeah, that shop's great. Yeah. That guy's cool.
So yeah,
he follows us on Instagram. Actually,
oh really? Nice. Yeah, dude, he's got this Benny. He's got this little storefront. It's tiny, but he's like, just music geek. He's got a whole little studio in there. He gives guitar lessons, like with the front door open,
I love it.
Onto the street.
It's that rules.
Oh, cute. Yeah,
that rules. I love the neighborhood, man. It's really nice right now because it's like has this like post-apocalyptic feel over here. You know, my little section is like I'm actually, I guess, like Alphabet City is like, cause I'm on right off D. So like you know, my area is still just like, you know, It's the one saving grace about like being a Philly dude that moves to New York and like always hating everything New York. You know, coming here like and living in this neighborhood, I fell in love with it like right away. You know, like I grew up in like Kensington, and you know, my neighborhood was mostly like, you know, poor Irish, Puerto Rican, and Black. So like this area is like, I feel like it's probably like the closest you can get to that. I mean, at least on the island before
in Manhattan.
You
could, sure.
Yeah, Manhattan. So it's cool. Like I just feel like I don't feel too weird about being here a lot. I do a lot, but you know, it's comfortable.
You can't help it. It's built into you. So what was the impetus for you? Like, how did you get to the city? I know, like, you know, for someone who's not from our area, the jump you made is quite the, not only a physical move, it's almost like a philosophical move because of how much we talk shit about each other growing up. So what brought you to the city? Why did you feel like you had to get out of Philly?
Well, I mean, honestly, like I talk like the New York hatred thing. Like even like when I find myself in like these heated sports things,
right.
which is like kind of dependent like on the year, to be honest. I'm in and out of following a lot of stuff, but I've never really been like agitated by New York teams, more just like New York fans. And I think right. it was more not even really about the sports. It was just, I liked confrontation, to be mm-hmm. honest, but that thought never crossed my mind moving to New York. It was more about just like leaving Philadelphia, which is something that I always knew was going to be something that I would do. Okay. And every time I had done it previously, it had been a complete failure. So New York always made sense to me just because like it's a, you know, you can throw a rock to Philly. When I get burnt out on New York, I head down to Philly. When I'm back burnt on Philly, which happens really fast nowadays,
okay.
I'm right back up here. So it's pretty good. I came here originally because my girlfriend is, she's a stylist up here and she needs to be on the scene. So
gotcha.
Basically I followed her 6 years ago. And I'm really here for no reason at all. Just to basically just like hyper spend my money faster than I'm built for pretty much. otherwise, besides that, I don't really leave the house very often. I mean, yeah. Nobody does right now, but, yeah, I think I missed like the 10 years ago, I would have probably really taken advantage of living in New York. But now I'm just like, I just moved here to sit inside of a small room, basically.
And how old are you?
39.
That's a good time to come to. I mean, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people at that age, you know, if you came in like your mid 30s, you know, I found the same thing living up that way is... It's not necessarily the party, the dinner, you know, there's that aspect of city living, which is going out, which is like the going out culture where you're, you know, never in the tiny apartment you rent. That's the reason it's tiny. But the other thing it offers, and, you know, just from knowing a little bit about you doing research is like, it offers that like anonymity where you get to exist without anybody knowing you exist. Do you kind of like enjoy that part of New York?
Yeah, I mean it's honestly it's great, and you can be involved if you want really easy, and you can kind of fade into a crowd unknowingly really easy as well. So I do really like that, and that's always been like my favorite part about New York City. It depends on, you know, like however you're feeling. I'm sure you can fathom that I've had my New York week long benders where I right. ended up in some really strange places, and you know, but it, for the most part for me it's just been a kind of like a retirement home.
Yeah Now when's the last time like I know all bets are off in quarantine but what you guys were kind of, you were all holed up in a house somewhere right in this last record, right? Like how did that come to pass? And were you actually like stuck there when the shit hit the fan, like the Rudy Gobert night?
Yeah, man. Shit was kind of crazy the way this happened. 2018, the end of 2018, I actually was like, was New Year's Eve of 2018 heading into 19. And I was in this apartment, in the same seat that I'm in right now.
Nice.
Just staring at this, staring out the window, kind of.
Wait,
listening.
Wait, what floor
to
are you on? Just to paint us a picture here.
Fourth floor, and perfect. Directly out my window is like a 25 story like housing building. So basically just like, and it's balconies. So I just like kind of, there's this Dominican dude that lives across from me that's like covered in tattoos, and he's just like always sitting outside smoking weed, and we just like. We often like wind up staring at each other for like 3 minutes before we realize we're doing it. It happens all the time. It's really strange, actually. But yeah, New Year's Eve, everyone was outside partying, and my girlfriend went to like a party and did some shit, and I wasn't really into it. So we were probably fighting or something, And I remember like sitting at home kind of just playing around with a guitar and kind of having this like this stress session with myself, like kind of, you know, deciding whether I wanted to kind of keep this going, or, you know, we're leaning into 10 years this year. So right. For me, like after that last record, Dance on the Blacktop, like I really enjoyed that record. We worked with John Agnello, and that was like a personal goal to work with John. And, you know, I just didn't really see like what I wanted to see out of it. And it just kind of, you know, we lost a couple members and put some new people back to fill in the spaces, which is really typical for us to do, right. Since the beginning. But you know, there was a lot of indecision on what I wanted to do. And I just kind of was weighing my options, knowing that I was going to be leaning into like, a lot more responsibility on writing again, like kind of reminiscent to like the early days of this project.
Right.
And, you know, I had these like goals that I wanted to get done with this record, which was really much just kind of, you know, dealing with this certain time in my life that like made me start this thing in the beginning. And I hadn't really got any of that completed. So, you know, I've always worked best when I've had my back against the wall, and I felt like my back was pressed against the wall. There was a lot of self-doubt and all this stuff. So
sure.
I think that kind of just sent me into a different mind state, you know, like, you know, I like when things don't seem like that. I like when something's telling me I can't do something, I typically, react to that. So
yeah, sure.
I wound up demoing through the night on New Year's Eve and started demoing to like 6 a.m. And you know, I continued to just demo here for that whole next year until we booked time with Will.
Wow.
So yeah, when we did book the time with Will, it was supposed to be April. And we started talking in January. We seen the coronavirus was like kind of starting to grab a hold. We had just got back from Asia in October, which is crazy.
Oh wow.
Like we did like face masks there and everything, because you know, like the, like we were playing Korea and Japan, and
right.
they, you know, we were pretty ahead with the face masks. We didn't even really realize it, but,
yeah, crazy.
Yeah. We, you know, we booked the time with Will, for April. January rolls around, we start seeing that there's problems on the horizon. We keep an eye on the situation. We wind up pulling the dates to the beginning of March, and we make a decision like, you know, if we get into the studio and this shit hits the fan, which it looks like it's gonna, you know, we're just going to have to lock in for 5 weeks. And,
I see. And
so, you know, we all made like the pact, like whatever happens, where this is it, you know? So
yeah, once you open the door,
that's it.
Doors open, yes. You walk through, you're in.
And you guys are familiar with Conshohocken at all?
Not sure. No,
it's out like by like, King of Prussia Mall
in, okay.
Outside of Philly.
Yeah.
It's a ghost town. It's a ghost town regularly, essentially.
Right.
So we get there and, you know, we knew what we were getting into, and, you know, we got in, I think like March 6th, which was, you know, 2 weeks before it like popped off here, you know?
Right. Sure. Is there an actual studio there? Or you guys rented a house?
No. It's a Will Yip studio. Oh, 4.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So it's like I worked out at Airbnb with this person for a house, right cool. next door to the studio. And we stayed there for 5 weeks and, kind of watched the world unravel
yeah,
on itself.
Yeah.
Pretty stressful point. You know, like you remember during that time, like there was like rumors that everybody's getting those fake texts, like saying that they were going to shut down the bridges and tunnels.
Yes.
Yeah, but like it all seemed like logically possible.
Sure. Yeah, why not?
And it was so stressful trying to be in the studio and like work on this record, but also like, am I going to have to like do some fucking escape from New York type shit to get like my people out of there, like my yeah. dog, and you know, like what's going on? So it was kind of a mess, but.
Was there any like
idea what we're gonna get into?
Were you like were you able to full on mentally just be like, all right, this is a fucked up situation, I'm all in on this record, Or were you being like pulled by the outside? Were you feeling guilty about not being home or being around your people?
Yeah, there was a whole lot of that. That's kind of what I was insinuating. It's just like, stressed about the record because, you know, like what I mentioned, just like these hurdles being put in front of us with this and having everything on my shoulders again, was tough. But then at the same time, I have to, it's not even that I can just like black out like the stuff that's going on outside the studio because I'm attached to it. You know, my people are there. I'm worried about my people. I'm wondering if I'm making the right decision being there. You know, there was a whole lot of that. So yeah, the whole studio time was just like, it was just stressful as fuck. And I just drank a lot the whole time I was there.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That was kind of that's always kind of the answer by the end of it.
Hey, listen, I was like a maybe once or twice a week scotch drinker prior to this quarantine. Mm-hmm. And that greatly went up, you know, like there's it was like all bets are off. Cause like you were saying in March, anything was possible. You know, how the fuck were we supposed to know how this was going to pan out? And that type of anxiety is just, it's crippling. So it's crazy though. I mean, you talked about how you sort of work best when your back's against the wall. Now, obviously this time it was something the world did that put your back up against the wall and you didn't have much to do with it this time. But to go back a little, you were talking about how, you know, Dancing the Blacktop was, you know, a record you were very proud of and you got to work with someone you wanted to work with and it was well received and all that stuff, but you still felt by the end of that cycle and by that New Year's that like unfulfilled, you know, where do you think that came from?
You know, I feel like I always have had that in me. So it's hard for me to tell whether I'm expecting too much out of myself or if there's just the expectations are even conceivable in the first part. So for me, I knew that there was a plan, like, you know, I started this project in 2010, like out of like pure desperation, you know, like I was at my end. And I was looking to grab onto anything. I know that sounds very dramatic, but it's like, it's quite like a fact of that where I was. Sure. I was in a really bad place and I came up with this idea in my head. It was a pretty naive idea at the time that I was going to just, I needed to like address this one decade of my life, this, you know, that 99 to like 2009, 10, you know, that 10 years of my life was, you know, I moved through that period, nonchalantly, like there wasn't things that I needed to address. And I moved through it like the way that I was taught to grow up, you know, to deal with problems. It's just like by avoiding them and moving on, you know, and that wasn't the answer. And it kind of came to a boiling point.
Old Italian Irish Philly, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's you drink and you stuff it down. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I came home from prison and, you know, came home to a handful of dead people and, my life had been like, you know, blown to smithereens essentially, you know,
while you were away, like things got significantly worse.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, like my situation myself was obviously not ideal, but like what was going on at home was just like, you know, it was like Shakespearean, you know, like uncles and some of my closest friends just like, you know, being involved in like some really terrible accidents and stuff like that. Not being able to see funerals and all that stuff is really hard to swallow, you know, stuff you can't ever forgive yourself for.
It's intense. Yeah.
So, you know, and I came home and, it was like, there's no time for you anymore. It's get your shit together and move on, you know, and that's kind of what I tried to do. And you know, there needs to be readjustment back into things. And I was fucked up before I went into prison. I was fucked up when I came home from prison. And, right. you know, so for me, this idea that I came up with, this like naive idea that like turning back to music again, even though I'd kind of given up on it after, you know, the reason I kind of gave up on music was one of the people that passed was my friend Josh Schillig, who was like my co-writer in Horror Show.
I gotcha. Yeah.
He got killed in a motorcycle accident, like a really freak accident. And that kind of just like, you know, we had all these plans when I came home to like kind of try to start doing what I was doing with nothing with him. Fuck.
Yeah.
So that kind of just threw us something in the gear there and it just stopped me from doing it. And next thing I know, when I was home, I was just like within like 6 months, I couldn't get a job. So I was selling coke and I was hanging out at the bars and like, you know, I was just like back to like the shit that I was doing before, which was like, you know, I was surviving, you know, but it was
winds
a ticking
up.
Time bomb.
Yeah, you know where
it was
winds
a ticking
up.
Time bomb. Yeah. I was on parole. You know, the parole rate in Philly right. is like, it's 95%. It's like Jesus. 1 out of every 20 complete. So,
yeah, wow. Wow, really? It's that fucking low? That's crazy.
Yeah, it's
oh
nuts.
My God. Wow.
So I had this idea, you know, that I needed to turn back to music and I needed to write a record and I needed to get this all off my chest. And that was going to be like the way that I fixed myself. And, you know, I thought maybe I got to it with Guilty of Everything, but I never really felt that completion, like you said. And, I felt unfulfilled and, you know, as we moved past Guilty of Everything into Tired of Tomorrow and Dance on the Blacktop, you know, I kind of relied on other people in the band to kind of like help me get through, you know, the songwriting and stuff, you know,
because
this was a new world for me, you know,
sure.
like, and working with Brandon for a couple of years and Kyle and stuff, like they had really interesting stuff to bring into the like dynamic of what I wanted to do with Nothing.
Right.
And I obviously changed the direction in a lot of senses, and it became more of a band and not like the Dominic Palermo thing,
right,
you know.
Right.
And you know, I think I started to realize when I was demoing The Great Dismal that like that I was back to where I needed to be with this thing. And you know, I love all the everything we've done in the past has been like super sincere and meaningful, and it's gotten me obviously like has done things that I can't explain for my well-being and stuff.
Sure.
But you know, I needed to get back and I needed this kind of pressure. And I started to realize that what I was doing was exactly what I was supposed to be doing. And it kind of made sense in the grand scheme on a 10-year scale that this is how long it was going to take in the beginning, you know,
right.
I thought it was Guilty of Everything that was going to be the record, but I really feel like I feel that fulfillment now with this record. Like I did as soon as we heard Rough at Will's, like I knew that I finally kind of got done what I needed to do.
That's awesome. Now, like it's interesting, you know, from your point of view, you know, it's, you know, you said you were out of prison and you needed, and you know, going down a bad path and you grabbed onto something. But, you know, from my perspective, you built something, which shows like, you know, a lot of self-awareness to know that, you know, you were having problems and the problems were going to get worse and needed to create something as an outlet for those problems. So I think you could give yourself some credit there too. You didn't just like jump into a band that was already moving and got lucky and were in the right place at the right time. You know, you felt the need, you had a void and you filled it with the thing you needed to. And maybe that's why your music is good and authentic, is because it actually comes from that place. You can give yourself a little credit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not used to really patting myself on the back too much, but like, you know, I did realize, you know, I started to realize, and as I, like, I had this really excellent group of like support around me, like not only this Doyle and Kyle and Aaron, all super talented people, and they helped shape this record. Will and Nick helped shape this record. But like the support group was just like, you know, them telling me, you know, reminded me that what I was doing was really important and, right. and stuff like that. And hearing people say that, and because, you know, I'm my worst enemy. I always have been. Right. So like I tell my things to get myself to stop this, what I'm doing. And, just having them around, really, if they weren't there, then none of this would have happened. I would have not have had that extra push. Cause I quit on myself several times during this and, you know, and it was really just my own self and the self doubts getting to me. But, you know, the one thing that, you know, the grasping thing, the one thing that prison did teach me is that I didn't want to be there anymore. Yeah. Sure. And I didn't want to go back. Even though I fucked around for a little while, I think like the out of the desperation that I say it was like, yo, you're like on your way back there. So like, it's no longer like if you keep this up, like you're already there. Just like you need sure. to make a move right now.
What was your relationship? You know, what was your relationship with music when you weren't in jail?
It's strange, man. There's a lot of different levels to it, I guess. You know, I've always been a fan of hip hop and
yeah, me too.
You know, I grew up, you know, my early years was always like, you know, listening to Nirvana and to Oasis, but also listening to like Eazy-E and fucking sure. yeah. like all this West Coast rap, like, okay. you know, like, you know, but I've always been a fan. So it was cool to be able to like enjoy, listening to Hot 97 for the first time, because my prison was in Trenton. So like we picked up Hot 97 there.
Sure, sure.
You know, I never really knew what good radio was until Hot 97. And that's a straight up diss to Philly.
Oh, dude, I'll take it.
Our radio sucks. Our radio sucks in Philly.
I just recently moved to your radio, and I'm not stoked about it. No, I miss Hot 97 and Funkmaster Flex.
Yeah, man, it was cool hearing that at nighttime. And I had three tapes.
Okay.
And one I got. When I'm talking about prison, I can get like you're talking about off track, like
yeah, that's the point.
If you talk to somebody who's done a bid, they can get really off track. It's like the same as like a guy who goes to military. I feel like they just
it's a unique experience, unlike anything that most of the people who are listening to this will probably understand. So
yeah. But absolutely. So okay. Without like digging too much, but I had a girl that I was like friends with at that time that I was locked up, and I was on a minimum security status. So basically, towards the end of my bid, we would go in like a group of eight people, and I was like the foreman. It was me, a cop, and then the other dudes. And we would work in these office buildings, or like we would do like grounds work at like cemeteries and stuff like that. We built cubicles and stuff, and everyone was making moves out of those details, obviously.
Of course. Okay. Right.
So the cop that was on our detail, I won't say his name, just even though. Whatever.
This is the right time to let people know what cops are up to.
Well, you know, it sucks because like he was a dirty cop, but he was also like the coolest one that I could find.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
But I sent him down to Philly one night to hang out at the bars that I was connected to, and I told my people at home, like, yo, if this dude ever comes in, like, take care of this fool.
Sort him out.
And
yeah, yeah.
So this dude went down there and he had like they took care of him. He had a good night. Like he you know, he met some girls. Like he had like a really good night. And he came back.
That's pretty gangster, man.
Yeah, it was cool. I felt like the man when he came back. He was just like, dude, what the fuck? Like, you guys are, your friends are all. So anyway, from that point on, it was like I could do whatever I wanted when I was out on these details, which I mean, I kind of was, that's what I was planning on, but you know, like little things, like I wasn't bringing back drugs or anything like that. I brought back some weed a couple times and some like black and milds and cigarettes during like a drought. But this girl would basically drop these packages off for me, and I would just I'd grab them and I would just stick them in my pants. And then when we got back to the unit, the cop would never, he wouldn't strip search me. A lot of the times he would tell me, like, he would have like some McDonald's left over or something like that. He would just be like, just stick it in your pants and like, just don't get caught with it. Right. So I would go back onto the unit with like fucking three big ass Big Macs and like Black and Miles cigarettes and weed
just in,
or something.
In your pants.
And I was killing it in there. Like everyone loved me. They were like, they were like, you're the wildest white dude we ever met. You know what I mean? So I was like kind of like a mini legend in there for a second. It was pretty funny. But one of the tapes that they gave me, she brought me in a new order tape.
Oh, there you go.
So it's like a New Order best of tape. So I had that, and I had the Locks, We Are the Streets, and I had a DMX tape. So those are the three tapes that I had in prison. But besides that, it was radio for pretty much.
Mostly radio. So you really didn't, for those couple years, you didn't really know what was going on, like punk hardcore scene so much.
Nah, and honestly, I was over it, to be honest. Like most of my friends that were like wrapped up in like the scene, like in the hardcore scene, were like, they took a turn when I left. Like people started doing gang shit, and I was never really about the gang stuff. Like in a hardcore scene, we were always kind of like, it was a rough scene, it was a violent scene and stuff where we came from.
Philly, but at like, the time, was that like what, like Ninth Circle, FSU,
Yeah, yeah, all that shit started going off.
They tried to beat me up once. Yeah.
They try to beat a lot of people up. And that was the thing that I didn't like about that. Like the reason I got into that music was I was always an outcast. I was always the guy getting bullied and stuff like that. And when they did that, like I was not on board, and a lot of our relationships like really fell apart from that point on, and like they separated. So a lot of those guys, you know, it's weird. Like I get connected to them just like out of it, but you know, by the time I had went to prison, that was like the end of it, you know, for me. And I never looked back. I actually wound up having problems with a lot of those guys myself later on because of that, me not wanting to be a part of them, you know, they tried that, but you know, it all worked itself out.
Sure. That's pretty wild, man. There's something that seemed to be like a recurring pattern when I was, you know, looking into your story, and there seems to be sort of like a kind of like outsider's fascination with like your past and your story, almost like the people asking you like feel guilty about their own experience or their own credibility and kind of seem to like spin it back on you. Do you pick up on that? It kind of seems like a weird, lonesome spot to be in, especially when dealing with like music press and stuff.
I mean, thank you for saying that, because I mean that's absolutely is the case. Okay. I feel like we're and it's my fault at the end of the day. Like I put myself into these positions, so I have to. That's the one thing that really sucks about this is at the end of the day, I always have to look back on myself that I'm the reason that I put myself in these positions.
Sure,
but I mean, you think like this is 20 years ago at this point, you know, and like, I don't mind talking about this stuff because it was so important about the part of everything that my life embodies. You know what I mean? I don't mind that. The things that get irritating sometimes is like how lazy people are with such a thing. And a lot of that has to do with just like me and who I am and then what my situation is, you know? We don't get really, we've never been treated fairly by press or anything like that. And I've been vocally like pretty arrogant back to them. So like that doesn't really solve anything a lot of the time. But you know, like that's just me. You know, like I have to hear like really lazy comparisons. And like my life is that easy and not that complicated. You know, right. Like
yeah,
our first Pitchfork review, this the jackass like. Called, like made us a comparison to like shoegaze Beanie Siegel. It was just like,
what?
And this is the type of like cringy stuff that I've had to deal with my whole life because people don't understand. Like,
and that was like simply because of your experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Like, that's like that's to me is like the most ignorant shit ever. It's like,
yeah, that's fucking
whack. My hardship shit didn't start with like. And my introduction to that world didn't start with prison. I had been in CFCF like 3 or 4 times at this point. Like right. My whole life, like leading up to that point was built for me to end up in that situation. You know what I mean? Like it's not as easy put as the way that it is, but you know, I mean, it's just the way that the world works. Like not everyone has time to digest everything. So for the most part, I just try to my best to like not let things get to me and to understand that, you know, not everyone has the time for that. And people are stupid.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing. I mean, people are stupid. Like, and that's just the way it is, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, I'd say more so than stupid. It's like they're naive, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, someone sees that blip on someone's life and they're like, oh, 2 years there. That's like, that's kind of cool, you know, because they don't actually know like what's going on to someone's life when it's happening. But yeah, it's something that seemed pretty obvious when I was looking into this.
It's crazy. Like I've heard people tell me that like I've seen people like say like in comments on, you know, 2 years isn't that long, which it isn't. My friends that are still locked up right now. My friend Timmy just came home from a 10-year sentence. You know, like I know, trust me, like I had a 7-year sentence. I managed to slide after 2 years. Like,
okay.
Like I don't know how, like I shouldn't have, I should have did 3 or 4 probably. And then I have like, you know, dealing with press, like going through this band through the years, like people that call me a bro and stuff, you know, like which is to me is so fucked up because like I have an accent and I talk the way I talk and I've done what I've done, so like the easiest way for like you know these like publications is like to call us like bros, like that kind of shit like always irritated me. It's like these people are the same people that like sit there and talk about fighting for like criminal justice reform, but like would easily write me off. And like,
exactly.
You know, the same, you know, it's all the same people. Like,
yeah.
It's who I am. It doesn't fit what they want completely. So they don't know how to explain it. And it turns into, you know, whatever they can do to figure it out, I guess. But,
totally.
You know, no one ever says this shit to my face either, so I don't really think about it too much. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, like I'm around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like I'm right here. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually kind of goes perfectly into another question I had. Like, based on your experience, say you're boss for a day. What is one thing, the most important thing you would change about the criminal justice system?
I mean the mandatory minimum stuff is just like absurd.
Right.
I know Larry Krasner is doing a lot in Philly right now to try to help that. But there, I mean, the system is just so fucked up in Philly altogether. I mean, the conditions in these places, and I can't even. This is. You know, 20 years ago, again, the conditions were fucked up then. And I can't imagine. I hear stories about how bad it's been during COVID. But I mean, if I could change one thing, it would have something to do with the mandatory minimum or the way that probation and the probation system works in Philadelphia, because it's the most obvious revolving door like situation.
Yeah,
and it's insanity that it's still like that, and that no one could do anything about it, because like once you catch a charge, it's next to impossible to get out. Man,
yeah,
like the probation officers are corrupt. Everyone's corrupt around it. The judges are corrupt. It's Philly might be one of the most corrupt places ever. As far as that stuff goes, I have some friends that have like worked in the system, and we've had these really long, like, you know, when I tried to get involved with that a little bit, like I made some really weird, crazy connections that I never thought I'd be involved with, and hearing it out of like people's mouths who are actually educated on it, it's like, man, it's really sad, and it's really scary that like, you know, that especially, you know, like Black kids in Philly are just like, it's like cattle, the way that they're scooped up and put into the system, man. It's just unfair, and it's so fucked up. And it's still just goes on like nothing.
So in your estimation, like the things you saw are, do you think it happened as a matter of, you know, time and confusion, or do you think this was like very intentionally set up? Once you get someone on paper, you kind of keep them in.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of these charges are, you know, a lot of these charges, you know, were sketchy in the first place, like how these people got arrested, what they got charged for, you know, like cops pulling people over without reason, and little bit of weed for the man, like the mandatory minimum stuff. Like, it's like the perfect setup.
Right.
It's like, okay, you're not going to get any time. We're not gonna put you in jail, but we're gonna give you 3 years probation,
yeah,
and you're never gonna be able to get off of it,
right?
You know what I mean? Like you're gonna get dirty urines. You're gonna, even if you miss a time, if you miss an appointment,
right,
they tack time onto it. So
right,
like I have some youngins that are like kids that I've like, you know, grew up with that are.
Yeah, yeah.
Got that, like, are good kids, like union dudes and stuff like that, like, you know, like and they got like a weed charge when they were 19,
right,
and they're like,
yeah,
28 years old right now, and they're still on probation.
Ugh.
And they still have a probation officer, and they never got another charge. They just got more time added on to their probation, and it's like, it's crazy. It's like, how are you on probation? It's like, yeah, it's like fucking got caught with weed again, or, you know, or like I missed an appointment. So they tack, yeah, on. It's crazy, man. It's insane. I feel like if the rest of the country really had an understanding on what was going on, there would be like an immediate change, because it's just like, it's absurd.
I'm not so sure about that. Cause I mean, from what I can understand about it,
yeah,
that system is kind of serving a very functional purpose for probably at least, mm-hmm, half this country. And I don't know if they really wanted to change all that much.
Yeah. I mean, you're right there too. It gets pretty deep for sure.
I mean, when you talk about the working stuff, you know, I just recently was doing some research into, just cause I fucking don't sleep at night and go on wormholes and stuff, and seeing that it was over, I forget the exact number, but at least half and more of the economy that came into the state of Alabama in the year 1900 was work done by the prison population. And
yeah,
when you see this, like, I mean, you could make the argument that slavery never really stopped if you include,
yeah,
what happened with the prison system and where it stands now. I mean, you could make that case, because you can go from A to D without skipping any steps, and it's kind of right there, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, man. Yeah.
Well, I've worked the highways, you know, like,
yeah, exactly.
I've been out there on the turnpike in Jersey, yeah, like in all orange, like picking, right, up trash, looking for like half drank bottles of fucking booze. Like, you know, like I've been there. So like, yeah, you know, I think we got paid 19 cents a day.
Fuck.
And you know, that's cool that they even pay you, because like you work every day, you have to, and then you know a couple of weeks go by and you got enough to buy like a rack of soups or something, a rack of ramen right. or so yeah, like yeah. people need that in there. Like I had it good, you know, I had a good supporting cast for the most part while I was in there, and it's a rough life for sure.
So basically, moral of the story, try not to go there.
Yeah. Do your best not to go there.
All right. Let's have some fun now. Okay. So I did this for fun because I knew we'd be talking about Philly a lot. So I got 5 fun facts about Philadelphia for you. Okay.
All right.
You ready?
Sounds good.
Okay. So okay. Did you know 1 in 6 doctors in America are trained in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I didn't know the exact number, but I know that that's a thing. I think that's one of the main reasons why the Philadelphia real estate market is like the only one that's like functioning and actually doing well, thriving in this during this time.
Interesting.
The one thing from Philly that has happened is growing up, a lot of my older friends were from Fishtown and Port Richmond, and they you know, in the early 2000s, they started transition to real estate because they were mm-hmm. selling all their parents' homes for them. And now I have this like massive, all my scumbag loser friends from Philly basically all got into the real estate market, and now they're super successful. And, you know, and I get updates pretty much, and I still don't own anything. So, jokes on me, but, yeah, that makes sense. And I think a big reason is because of the medicine, it's like the medicine mecca, basically.
Yeah. It's something like that. All right. Did you know the Philadelphia Eagle was named after the eagle on posters during the National Recovery Act during FDR's New Deal?
I did not know that.
That's a fun one. What then?
Is that Swoop?
Is that his name, Swoop?
I don't know. Did I just make that up?
I mean, it sounds right. I believe it.
I don't think I've liked the Eagles since fucking. Maybe since I was pretty excited for it for Hurts that I Foles was cool, but I'm pretty on the fence about the Eagles, to be honest. So
yeah. Well, you come over and be a Giants fan. So, home to the first general.
Maybe the Jets.
Yeah, that's fine. If you want to live a life of perpetual frustration, just move to New York and be a Jets and a Mets fan. It's actually kind of ties into the similar. Nothing. It's to nothing's whole vibe perfectly. I think you should be a Jets and a Mets fan.
Yeah.
So it was home to the first general use computer built in 1946, weighing 27 pounds. It was home to the first newspaper, the Philadelphia Packet and Daily Advisor in 1784. And this is one I think you'll like. It hosted the first organized protest against slavery. It was called the Germantown Quaker Petition Against Slavery. And it was the first organized protest against slavery in all of America. So there you go.
I never knew that.
So you got one that's good thing
cool.
about Philly.
Germantown, man. Germantown has just always been cool. I always loved Germantown.
Still hip, right?
Yeah. I mean, Aaron grew up, our bassist Aaron, he spent his early days in Germantown before he moved out to the suburbs. Germantown has just always had such a fucking cool vibe to me. Like everyone I've ever known from Germantown has been just like a ice cold snake, man. Like just like just a gangster always. I don't know what it is about Germantown. I always loved my Germantown people though.
That's awesome.
The ones that are from there.
The real deal.
I don't know what's there now. I can't vouch for what's going on anywhere in Philly anymore. Okay. So
you said quickly that you're from Kensington and
I grew up in like Wissanoming, Frankfort area first.
Okay.
And then when my old man left, my mom had to pick up extra work, so I moved down to Fronton, Indiana, from like I guess like 8 to 12. I lived down there.
Okay.
So I'm a Blue Line baby, man. Like I've been up and down like the Frankfurt L tracks pretty much my whole life.
Got you.
From like Bridge and Pratt to like K&A.
Blue Line baby. I never heard that. That's great.
Yeah.
So my sister went to Drexel and dated a guy from Kensington, and I went out to eat with this guy once and watched him eat a bunch of Scrapple. Okay. Now, can you explain to the people not from Philadelphia what the fuck Scrapple is? And do you love it as well?
I mean, honestly, it's gross.
I mean, what is it like, even? It's just loose meats?
I think it's just like leftover stuff just pressed and then fried.
Right.
I think it's all pork. I'm pretty sure it's all like byproduct. I think it's weird. Like when you press it, you can kind of see some hairs in it sometimes. Oh,
no.
Like, and by hair, I mean like you'll see like you'll just see like a, not like a fucking long black hair or something.
Right,
like,
right.
It. Like you'll see it, like you'll kind of just catch like some peach fuzz or something on it. It's pretty gross, man. I've never really been a fan of Scrapple, to be honest, but okay. I pretty much will eat anything that's put in front of me.
Okay.
But you know, it's funny, my grandfather who actually I lived with in Kensington, he had an apartment on Front in Indiana, like right across the street from this big yellow library in this park, which if you go there right now, it's like easily one of the most fucked up places you'll ever see in your entire life.
What's that?
It's just like, it's overrun. 'Cause they have like, you know, anyone could openly shoot down there now again.
Oh, okay.
And it's just mayhem, man. It's like watching like the Walking Dead for real. Like, It's insane. And it was bad in the 90s too. It was just as bad in the 90s, maybe, when I was down there. Yeah, he would cook like shit like that all the time. Like, kibasi and like Scrapple. It was just meat always. There was never anything else. It was my mom's dad. He was a boxing corner man, and he worked at Henley, BC.
Oh shit.
Which was like a really famous gym, and he was a corner man and trainer, and he trained with Sugar Ray Leonard Holyfield. He was friends with all the fighters down there. They loved him because he was a drunk. And when he would go to AC, everybody would want to drink with him because he was just always drinking. He loved Crown Royal. And when I was a kid, I'd go to his house and stuff, and I'd have all my toys like bagged up in those little purple Crown Royal bags. And like, you know, like back then I was just like, oh, these bags are cool. Like just keep
nice velvety
going. And
bags,
I never realized I had like 15 of them with all little toys in them and shit. And I just never realized like, wow, this fool is really getting it in with some Canadian whiskey, you know, like, but, yeah. And I mean, his apartment was like something out of like a Rocky movie. It was down in Kensington. Like it was right next to the L. So every time the L went by, I can remember like the wall shaking and he had all these photos of in little shitty frames all over the walls with him and all the fighters and like other sports players, all over his walls. You know, it was the real deal. And then when the L would go by, you'd see them shaking and stuff. It was, you know, you can't really like, it was really cinematic looking back on it. But yeah, he was in AC and they all liked him a lot. And around that time, not to go off subject again, but, the reason why I was never really a big Eagles fan, we kind of turned into a Bills fan because he, while he was in AC, that famous Buffalo Bills team that never won the Super Bowl, the Jim Kelly, Dermot Thomas, and like
Andre Reed,
Don Beebe, all that. Yeah. They would go to AC all the time.
Bruce Smith, of course.
Bruce Smith too. Yeah. Like one of the nicest, kindest people ever. He was really, really friends with these guys because they loved partying with them.
Oh,
and
wow.
He had pictures with them all the time. And he like, they signed cards for me and stuff. And he brought them back.
Wow.
So I became a Bills fan kind of just by default from sure. that. And now that I know that they were probably getting wrecked on fucking Crown Royal, just makes it even cooler, to be honest.
Oh, man, what an interesting guy. Did he ever teach you anything about boxing?
Yeah, I mean, we in the early days, like, you know, I never got golden gloves or anything like that. But like we trained and threw some hands. And then later on in life, I kind of got into it on my own accord a little bit. But never really followed through with it.
That's crazy. Did it trail off anywhere else in your family? Any other boxers?
Yeah, I mean, his brother was a champion fighter from wow. Philly. And if you see a picture of this guy, man, my mom just sent me a picture of him the other day. He's like, it's him and her dad, my grandpa, and they're standing next to each other. And my grandpa's like kind of tall. And this dude next to him is just like an ogre. And he's like 40 years old at that point. And it was like, I think he fought like 60, 70 fights or
wow.
something.
Okay. Is that
I think he was a John Miller too. So I'm, good luck finding out anything about him. I should actually okay. probably.
right. Yeah. Right. Wow. That's really wild, man. Yeah. Okay, so I want to bust into a little segment we do on the show called Mystery Friends.
Okay.
Okay, so what happens now is I hit up one of your friends or somebody you know. They told me a story. So I'd like you to kind of tell me the story of what that experience was like or if it was funny or not.
Okay.
And then try to tell me who told it. Okay. This mystery friend sometimes they miss the point a little bit. They always give me a good story, but they're really easy to figure out. Okay. So this one okay. told you to ask Nikki, by the way, I haven't known what to call you because you're called Dominic, Nikki.
I don't fucking know either, man.
Online.
I don't fucking know.
Yeah. I was like, cool. I'm going to speak to Dominic Nikki Palermo today, which means I might get a cement foot bath after this, you know?
Yeah. when you figure it out, let me know. They still like if they do use media uses my name, they'll spell it like if they use my full name Dominic, they spell it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. It's crazy. It yeah. doesn't matter. Who gives a shit?
So anyway, you said ask Nikki to tell you a story leading up to the band showing up at the studio Dreamland. Apparently people were waiting for you outside, the van showed up. And the door opened, and apparently you guys just came out in like a plume of smoke and drink or whatever. Like, oh, do you remember yeah. pulling up to the studio and what the vibe was?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a fucking nightmare, actually.
Oh, really?
I was in a suit still, I think. I had a wedding the night before.
What? Okay.
I had a wedding the night before. It was like one of the guys I bartended with, too. So like it was an all bartending attended wedding. So like okay. an open bar sure. in the middle of like Northeast Philly too. It was like a 5-hour drive to the studio. So I like was adamant to everyone like, yo, we're meeting at the Union Transfer let us park our van there a lot of the time when we had okay. equipment in it. So cool. it would be safe. So I was like up everybody's ass. I was like, nobody fuck up. Like, don't fuck around. We got to be there on time. This is a serious fucking record, you know?
Yeah,
and this
right.
we were like in prime degenerate nothing at that point.
Okay.
Like we were like maniacs, like as far as partying went, like
okay.
it was like, it was a dangerous time to be a part of this group. but I was like very adamant, like, yo, like get here, don't fuck up. And I wound up showing up like an hour late and I didn't sleep yet. So someone started handing, we were drinking whiskey, like, you know, we were drinking like rocks glasses with like Jameson and just like shooting them. And it was like one of those nights, there was a bunch of cocaine and then somebody handed me acid and then I ate mushrooms on top of the acid. But it was like insane. I was up all night. I rolled to the Union Transfer to meet the van. And I was just like, I was an hour late. I was like, everybody was waiting for me. And I was a dickhead that was telling everybody to be right. there on time. I showed up, I was still in my suit. I lost the suit coat. So I had like a tie on and a white shirt.
Oh,
and
my
like,
God.
It was a mess. Getting to the van, I was like, yo, I need to go to sleep before we get to the studio.
Yeah.
So So we get there, we're like 5 hours late for the studio. And we open the door and John Agnello is standing there, like greeting us. He thought we were dead. 'Cause like I was the only one that had his cell phone and I was passed out with it in my pocket. No. So like he didn't know if we were coming or not. And we just opened the van and like, when we opened the van, like we all just kind of like stumbled out of it. Like, and it was a pretty intense situation for sure. That was day one of the studio. I think we went in there right away and just started tracking too. Like,
wow.
Like, there was a lot of booze drank at that session, especially. There was a liquor store down the road, and when I would walk into the liquor store like daily to like, we basically would get like 2 bottles of wine and then like a bottle of liquor a day. Uh-huh. And when I would get there, the guy would just be like on the internet at the liquor store, and he would just put a box up on the counter when I walked in and then just go back to what he was doing. It was pretty crazy, honestly.
What's the, like, all right, 2 bottles of wine and a bottle of booze.
A whole lot of beer and,
sure,
and other
and whatever and, else is yeah. happening. But yeah. What's like your schedule through the day that you can actually work? Are you taking it slow or are you just going for it right off?
We said 2 o'clock was our time that we could start like drinking. Basically, we like set a rule.
It's that, pretty
like,
early. No,
yeah, it's pretty early. It was pretty early. You know, I told someone else that before and I was like really proud of it. I was like, no, we had like a time limit. Like we had to start it too. But we would literally be like sitting there, like especially me and like Brandon, we would be like 1:58, like sitting there with like a can of Modelo and a shot of tequila.
Yeah,
like,
right.
All right, come on.
Just like, wanting 2 o'clock to show up a little too bad.
So, yeah. I mean, yeah. We were waking up at like 10, you know, we'd have a breakfast together and then we'd work for 4 hours. It's, you know, it seemed like a long time to be working.
Oh, it seemed like ages. Rules.
We had some rules.
What were the other rules to keep it together?
That was really it. No drinking before two. That was like the most important rule, because we should have put a cutoff at the back end of it too.
Yeah, sure.
It got ugly a couple times for sure.
Yeah. I heard another one about tequila night while you were cutting the piano version of Us, We and R, but I was told it got a little tumultuous and we should maybe not get into it tonight. Unless you want to tell that story. What happened with tequila night?
I rolled into the liquor store and I seen that they had a display up for, Los Migos, the George Clooney one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds
something
right.
like that. They had it. We actually rolled to the studio and we went to the liquor store at like 6 o'clock. So we had already been drinking. So that was a bad idea. 'Cause we wound up buying like 5 bottles of shit. And like, we bought all this weird shit. Like, we were trying to drink something different, like every other day or something, like, you know, so like we got some fucking Pernod the one day. And then we got like some weird Sicilian, like aperitif and stuff, like weird shit, you know, but they had a display up with George Clooney and we all thought that was hilarious. And we bought like this Casamigos. That's what it is. Casamigos.
It is Casamigos. Yeah.
Yeah. We drank it and for some reason it turned Brandon into like a complete psycho. Like he can't really drink. He was new to drinking like 5 years of it. And like, but like, you know, I'm like a full fledged alcoholic. Like I've been drinking in bars and working in the bars. Like I can drink, like I'm not a lot of people can drink like me.
Right.
But, he like turned into like a really ugly bad person that night. And we recorded that song live, just Nick playing piano and then Brandon in a isolated booth and me in an isolated booth, and then Agnello in the control room, and we were just talking to each other and just like kind of talking shit to each other in between takes.
And it got kind of real times. Right, it got real.
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, there's probably audio recorded of this somewhere, and I can't wait till like Nello pulls it out one day, because it was pretty good. Like, I think, you know, Agnello said something about like me being the lead vocal, and for some reason it got Brandon really upset. Oh. And he was like, "Oh, the lead vocal," or something.
Oh, I thought you pulled like a No Doubt, a No Doubt on you, or something.
Yeah, for sure, like the rest of the band. But you know, it was hilarious that he was just tripping. Like he didn't seem drunk. He felt he like seemed like he had taken drugs or something. Like, so the alcohol must have really did something to him. So that night I stopped talking to him, and we separated groups a little bit. And then that night, apparently he was outside. Like, I don't know if it was Agnello or somebody else like seen him. He was like out in the side yard of this thing. He was out in the woods, and he was like talking to himself and like talking to a tree.
Oh, wow.
Outside.
And yeah, then it the sounds like morning, he got his hands on something a little more than a tequila, doesn't it? Yeah.
Maybe. Who knows? It was kind of hard to get anything out there.
Right. Wow.
Who knows?
Intense. All right. So I'm assuming you can guess which mystery friend told me this.
I guess that was Agnello.
Yeah, it was John Agnello. Yeah.
That's great.
He even said on Tequila Night, he's like, "Nikki and Brendan really got into it. I had to step in and read them the riot act." He said, "I said to Kyle in the control room, should I step in or see how far this goes? He told me I should stop it immediately." So yeah, it sounds like, sounds like it got pretty heavy, because John's such a chill dude. I, you know, like imagining him like getting in the middle of a fight. I'm like, what?
Oh yeah. He, I don't think he understood what he was getting into when he, when he did this record with it. And by the end, I mean, I talked to John kind of frequently, you know, like,
sure.
We really got close. But like, he was like, I'd never seen a band drink like you guys. He's like, I've been around party bands, yeah, but like the way that we were drinking was just like, you know, like leaving Las Vegas, Nicolas wow. Cage style, like, it gets dark, but it's kind of funny too at the same time,
right? Like, it's not the thing you want to metal for per se,
yeah,
but John Agnello's recorded a lot of fucking bands. If you guys cool. took that crown, yeah, you know, it's okay, kind of impressive.
You know that was on my head a little bit too, like
we gotta be first at something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, they recorded Feel the Pain there, Dinosaur Jr. and right. That pop in the top in the beginning was a Glenn, I think Glenn Livett like 20 year or something. Ooh. And it's just like that pop, you know. Oh, they recorded that at Dreamland, and he was talking about it like the first day. He was like, yeah, by the end of their session in 5 weeks, they had like 10 bottles of scotch on the wall in front of the control mirror. I was like, You're going to see a little bit more than that.
Oh, you took that as a challenge, didn't you?
Yeah.
Big time.
It's like, we're, you know, there's only three of us drinking. You know, it was only me, Brandon, and Kyle, right, and then John occasionally, because Nick didn't drink. So, like,
I can picture it in your head, almost like a, like Dinosaur Jr., huh? All right, Philly, yeah, motherfucker, here we go.
Yeah, like I'm never going to play guitar as good as Jay, but like, sure. But
I'll know, drink more than him.
He better stay out of the way when it comes to the, you know.
That's fucking funny.
Anyway, then we got out of that record, and then we somehow made it out of that. I don't know how.
Yeah, you made it. It was a good fucking record too. You see, you keep making it back. Hey, Brad, yeah, do you have that thing queued up for me?
I do. Should I?
All right. Yeah, it's time. So
see if you can hear it.
So this is the first time.
This is absolutely the best podcast I've ever been a part of. Just to let you know.
Oh, that's good.
Thank you very much for your attention to detail.
So all right. So this is the first time we're ever doing this. This is a
great.
Wait, what should we call this, Brad? We need music for it.
This is a guest host.
Guest question? Guest host? All right. So we have a guest question today. Lay it on, Brad.
Okay, one more time, buddy.
My name is Ziki. Why didn't I'm nothing be a name at nothing?
So that is a guest from, as you guessed it, my son, Zeke, who's a big nothing fan. And I told him he could ask you a question today. So I know it's a little amateur, And you've probably answered it, but please answer my son's question.
It's honestly one of the questions that, like, I feel like I change my answer to every time. So it's a common one.
He's not a German. Treat him with respect, please.
I honestly was just about to say, is this a German? They kind of sounded the same.
My name is, yeah.
My name is Zeke. Why do you name the band Nothing? Is this a philosophical question, or you tell me?
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
Shit, man, that's awesome.
All right, so yeah answer his question.
Okay, well, a lot of this. The narrative around Nothing and like what it embodies was very much kind of created in that maelstrom of literature that I was reading when I was locked up and kind of continued reading when I came home. When it all kind of started with a little bit of, you know, Russian stuff, you know, Dostoevsky, sure, and
getting dark.
Gogol and stuff. Yeah, and it quickly transferred over to a lot of the French stuff and the existentialism and Sartre. I think Nausea was really the highlight for me of being really falling really in love with this idea. I think, you know, right around that point when we started this band, when I kind of gave it a name, I was reading this Thomas Ligotti stuff, and he kind of talks about like the process, which is life, and kind of being pulled from this like peaceful state of like nothingness, into like a screaming, loud, pain filled world.
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
And, that's kind of where it stemmed from. Early on was kind of that. But also, I was only planning on releasing like a demo or something like that, and like making like really rare, weird, obscure tapes with this originally. So I thought it would be kind of a good troll too, because it's like kind of this ungoogleable thing,
right?
And yeah. It wasn't until shortly after that I realized that I had only set myself up for like failure once again. But the joke was on me, as it usually is.
So, turn back on you. Well, that's
tears
funny.
Of the clown.
Now I got to explain to my son who Dostoevsky is.
I'll send them some Thomas Ligotti stuff. You can leave it for him. I'm sure that's what you need right now.
Yeah, I'll just slip it into the book collection for when he's ready.
Yeah.
So what's the most common and dumbest joke about your band name?
I mean, the who's on third kills me.
Yeah.
You know. And everyone who it's kind of like darkly humorous. Like, we had this conversation, like I kind of invite it sometimes just to like watch people like think that they have come up with something that like no one has thought of. And it's like, really? Oh, be like, yeah, it's like I told my mom I was listening to Nothing and she didn't understand. I'm like, really? What, like, wait, what do you mean? Like,
yeah, like, what is
she's
that?
Like, no, like, it's just like, yes, like she didn't get it that I was like actually listening to something. I was just listening to a band called Nothing. I was like, dude, that's fucking brilliant, man. That's hilarious. It's like, like imagine like being that oblivious to think that like I hadn't heard this before at all.
Yeah, you were dropping some dime on you. That's the best way to do it, though, is to bring people in that way, to make them think.
I mean, at the end of the day, they're trying to make you feel good. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
like,
if you force someone else to repeat something, then they often just know how dumb it was the second time they say it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't even get people to spell my first name right after 10 years of doing this. So like, this really does, I don't really give a fuck about much, to be honest.
Nah, what's the point of it? So say you could control your audience. What is the correct state to listen to a Nothing record? Like, do you want people sober? Do you want people stoned? Like, how do you, when you're crafting these songs, like, what do you think is like the ideal way of listening to it? Or understanding it, I guess, even.
I mean, I don't necessarily know, honestly. I think like for me, I guess a good example of this is like, you know, when we were going to put this record out this year, I was probably the only one in my camp that was pushing for this record to be put out this year.
Oh, okay.
Everyone wanted to maneuver it into 2021 just because, you know, like
it seems
more beneficial. Like you can tour around it. You're going to sell more records. You know, people thought that this was going to be like a busy time for music. And my whole point was just like, I make this music for me, you know, but I understand that the reactionary level that I've caused by doing this, and that there's a lot of people out there that really care about this music and it means a lot to them. And this is, you know, around this point, I had a lot of friends and acquaintances and people in Philly kind of, you know, they passed on. There's a, like, this fentanyl craze in Philly has just been like really tragic. Yeah, I've seen a lot of people that I've gone to school with, a lot of people, friends of brothers and family, like everybody's been really affected by that.
Yeah.
Plus I had, I had Riley from Power Trip, you know, he passed on, and then Wade from Iron Age.
Right.
So the one thing that I've managed to compile through this life is experience and not being in ideal situations. And I knew this was not going to be an easy thing for people to get past. It's really affected a lot of like, it's affected everybody, but it's affected musicians and a lot of my peers in the industry in a lot of really awful ways. I've foreseen a problem, and I still do. This winter, I think, is going to be exceptionally difficult. And unfortunately, I really hope I'm wrong, but I see it, a lot of problems and more of this kind of stuff happening. But, you know, I just wanted to get this music out because I felt like it needed to live in this year. It embodied this year for me. And I know that there is a lot of people out there that this could help lift them or help them get through like something. And for me, that's really important. So as far as like how I want people to perceive it, if they're making an effort to perceive it in any way, that's all I could really ask for. I guess that's the best way to put it.
I love that. It's a beautiful record. It really is. I really got into it pretty deep. I had listened to it when it first came out. I got into it really deep in the last couple of days, and it's cool. And I'm a big fan of your group, as you know. I've been hitting you up for a while about that.
And I
really like the progression. I like that you're trying different things and expanding and not staying in the same exact wheelhouse. I think it's really clever and it sounds great. I'm totally into it. I'm going to let you out of here. We got you for 90 minutes and I appreciate it. So this is my last question.
I honestly had a really good time talking to you guys. I appreciate you put some work into it and the questions and stuff. And I that's always much appreciated. So thank you.
Oh, no worries. Thank you for doing it.
Thanks, dude.
So you talked a little about so much of this is a culmination of your experience. And I've heard you talk about this in a couple of interviews. And since I'm someone fascinated with it too, I have to ask, besides for death, what is the closest version of peace that this earthly existence can offer you? Like, what's your perfect day? Which makes you feel at peace besides for this idea that our existence ceases and then you'll find peace?
Well, I'll tell you that I don't really understand the concept of like peace to be honest. Right. I don't know if I've ever really felt it complete peace before.
Sure.
I know I have these I have these instances where I feel invincible. And I think that's probably the closest that I could get to be feeling at peace. And I think that's like a, when I say invincible, I think that I achieve some sort of level at some point. You know, a lot of the time it's after a bender where I only sleep for an hour and I wake up and I'm still a little drunk, or, you know, I feel like a lot of those days start like that, where I just trudge on. But it's basically, it's those days where I'm most connected with what I think this existence is. Mm-hmm. And then I don't fear it, and I don't resent it, and that I'm at one with it being as, you know, truly as chaotic as it all is. And those kind of days is when I feel the most at peace, because I feel like I'm walking through fire and being unscathed. It's kind of a weird place to be. A weird way to explain it, but like, you know, being able to walk through that fire and have it not harm me.
Yeah.
And kind of like laughing as I'm doing it
is
when I feel most at peace, because I don't think that there is a true peace. I think that's what peace is, you know, is being able to sit there and have everything affect you, but be able to control it all. So,
yeah, that's awesome. It sounds liberating.
Yeah. So just get on a bender and then sleep for an hour and wake up and start drinking again. Yeah.
I don't know
why I thought of that. That's the moment. I honestly just some of those kind of days, and I don't have a lot of them left in me, I don't think, unfortunately. But
yeah,
you feel like you can just do whatever you want at those kind of days, and it's a nice feeling. That's why awesome. Being on the road with us for 30 days straight is like. Meanwhile, I'm thinking on those levels, and like the other dudes in the band are probably like looking over at me, like as I'm trying to explain this, like, what the fuck is this dude talking about?
Yeah,
I gotta get home.
Well, I gotta be honest with you, man. I did the research this interview, and sometimes I walk away going like, I think me and that guy would get along, and you're one of them, because I bum people awesome. Out all the time. I freak people out all the time because, you know, we're talking for like 90 seconds and I'm already on death, or I'm already on, you know, something else. And they're like, Jesus, like, I just wanted to catch up about your family, you know? So some people just, you know, have an ability to see through the bullshit, and maybe it's, you know, maybe it's who you are, or maybe it's the culmination of your difficult experience, but you know, some people just want to expose it to the bone and get down there. Some people don't, you know?
Thanks for
being one of the searchers. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for putting it that way. I really appreciate it. So
no worries, man. Well, thanks again.
Take care of little Zeke too, man.
Yeah, that's it.
Do him you got him playing drums already, huh?
Yeah, he's rocking out a bit. Yeah. I think he's
you're a mean dad. You know, he's just going to be the drummer in every band.
Listen,
now, for sure.
I already told him about publishing. He knows. I'm like, listen, kid, if you're going to play drums, you're still going to write the fucking songs. All right. Don't be like me.
Yeah.
Don't be like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't worry. He'll learn from the cautionary tales of his father.
Good,
I'm not going to spin a yarn that's incomplete.
Good shit. We're all pulling for Zeke.
Yeah. Let's pour one out for the Z man.
Hey, thanks again, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brad Mountain.
that's me.
What's up, Brad Mountain? How's it going? You know, it's disappointing. We went through so many things in this interview. I feel like I was on a human roller coaster. It was great. I enjoyed so much of this interview and really enjoyed talking to him. We didn't even get to the Sixers. There was like, you know, like when I first hit him up about doing an interview, literally my pitch was like, yo, come on, going off track. We'll fucking talk shit about the Sixers and maybe some other stuff, you know? Didn't even get to it.
Could you hear me back here with my fingers crossed? Like, come on.
Like, please. Don't talk about something I can't talk about.
Ah, come on. Let's do some...
Let's do the social media sites.
So, I totally forgot what I said now. These guys are Band of Nothing. Band of Nothing. Instagram, Twitter. You know where we are. We've already propped our Patreon account. But you can also, if you're a little more frugal or like most of us these days in the midst of a pandemic and you still want to do something, just give us a great review on iTunes. Or
yeah.
You can give us a little tip on Venmo at Off Track. That's all we need, man, is just to know you're out there listening to us.
You know what I'd like to see, Brad? Do you know how that a couple weeks ago someone left the comment on iTunes that was essentially like, it was a little sexually explicit,
yeah.
You know? He was saying that he would turn down oral sex, any number of things to listen to an episode of Going Off Track.
Right.
At first I was like, why can't the two be simpatico here, you know? Like, I don't know why sex and our podcast are mutually exclusive. Maybe should I lower the tone of my voice?
It is a podcast.
To make it a little sexier? Maybe I should. You and I, I'd say, we don't talk about it much on here, but we both have a past in our past. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think both of us enjoy some sexually explicit content.
Yeah,
honestly,
yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see somebody trump that review that I saw on iTunes with an even more sexually explicit and not like, oh, I just like, you know, like went down on my girlfriend. Like, I don't want to hear stuff like that. I want it to sound like a Teddy Pendergrass song. You know, tell me that you were listening to Going Off Track with some scented candles and some hot oils with like a fake bearskin rug, you know, maybe with a nice bolognese on the stove. And just, I want the whole mood to be set sexual. I want people in silk. I want them in ascots, you know? You feel me on this?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So this is my quest to the audience. Please make me happy, you know?
Make Benny happy. And if you can't do that, then just make him a Wikipedia page.
Ugh, still hasn't happened.
Right.
It's crazy. I don't know how many times I got asked for it.
Let's wrap it up.
Let's get out of here. Thanks again to Nikki. The new record is awesome. Everybody listen to Nothing. And thanks for listening to the program. Have a good week.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.